the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I'm glad you did. You're about to hear an in-depth interview with journalist Robert Perry from consortiumnews.com. We're going to take a close look at the evidence-free assertions offered by President Obama, Secretary of State Kerry, and others in the recent brinksmanship over Syria and chemical weapons. I want to thank the people who subscribe to my podcast and help support this effort, like Janet Price, Carol Krez, Cameron Troxell, and Gary Washington. If you'd like to subscribe, and I would very much like you to, just go to peterbcollins.com and follow the sign-up link right under my picture on the homepage. We can set you up for a 24-hour pass for $1. A monthly pass, cancel anytime, is $5. And our best deal is the annual subscription for $50. And I've got a bag of Kona coffee, lovingly grown by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And we'll send it along. I also have a couple more copies of Sibel Edmonds' Classified Woman bonus book for new annual subscribers. The other way you can support this podcast is to steer your web business to GoDaddy.com. I've been doing business with them for over 10 years, and they've got excellent customer service. Right now, if you sign up for web hosting with unlimited storage and bandwidth, the rates start at just $1.99 a month, and they will give you your domain name free. There's a link at the top of the show file for this podcast for another special deal at GoDaddy, and I hope you'll click on it. Journalist Robert Perry returns to our program today.
We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even...
Bob Perry, longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., and the publisher of ConsortiumNews.com, returns to our program today. Bob, always good to talk with you.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
You've been publishing some interesting pieces under your own byline and others regarding the dust-up about Syria and chemical weapons. And I wanted to focus today on some of the angles that you have taken since the August 21st incident in a suburb of Damascus. And we saw the United States, led by President Obama, really go to the brink of a military assault. And then the president shifted, saying he was going to get approval from Congress. And then he said, well, hold off because this diplomatic opportunity has opened up. But I want to focus on the events of the last few weeks. We're now speaking on the 25th of September, the day after Obama's speech to the United Nations, where he is still saying that the evidence is very clear that it was the Syrian government and its military that was responsible for this chemical weapons assault. And I wanted to get your thoughts because you've written very clearly about this and raised important questions about the sheer lack of evidence provided by the Obama administration for its very powerful assertions.
Right. The Obama administration has, from almost the beginning, blame the Syrian government for this attack, and that may turn out to be accurate. But the Obama administration has essentially refused to provide any of its own evidence to support that. On August 30th, it put out essentially a white paper, a four-page white paper, that was filled with we assert this, we assume this, but did very little, really nothing in terms of presenting evidence that could be checked.
And Secretary of State Kerry, in using that document, repeatedly used the phrase, we know this, we know where the missiles were launched from, we know that it was sarin gas, we know that the Assad government possesses these weapons. But it was all circumstantial evidence. There was nothing that really firmly established that it was the Syrian military that launched this gas attack.
Right. It was not even circumstantial, really. It was all we assess. And it was called a government assessment, which itself was a bit of a sleight of hand. The impression that was left to the American people was that the U.S. intelligence community had made this assessment. When the U.S. intelligence community does one of these examinations of what happened somewhere, they often do an NIE, or National Intelligence Estimate. Or they make an assessment, which is released through the Director of National Intelligence, reflecting the views of the 16 intelligence agencies. And those agencies often will disagree, and there'll be footnotes in these kinds of reports. They'll say, well, we doubt this, or we have reason to not believe this. And they present their evidence. In this case, the Obama administration did what I call the dodgy dossier, in that they created an impression that this was the view of the U.S. intelligence community, but the report was released by the White House press office, and it had this phrase, government assessment, which has never really been used before. And they didn't attach any evidence. They just said, we assess it, we assess this, we assess that. So the basic, the real sourcing of these allegations was very murky. And I think you have to look and go back to this whole the original point, which what people were asking at the time. The UN inspectors arrived in Damascus on August 18th. They were there at the request or agreement of the Syrian government to look at a couple of other sites where there had been alleged chemical warfare attacks, and in which the Syrian government was blaming the rebels. Rebels, of course, are blaming the Syrian government. So the UN was there to see what they could find out about those incidents. They were far outside of Damascus. So the UN inspectors were essentially unpacking their bags in Damascus when this, what appeared to have been a fairly major attack using chemical weapons, was launched on August 21st. So there was a scratching of heads of why would the Assad regime, which knew that it was under a lot of international pressure on exactly this point of chemical weapons, why would it have invited in the UN inspectors and then intentionally launched an attack just outside of Damascus, which would clearly draw the attention of the UN, which would draw threats from the United States, which had already been writing, putting down red lines and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always this question of, what sense did that make? Now, there are obviously ways you could look at it. There could have been a group in the Syrian military that was just acting on its own out of some outrage or craziness. It could have been some kind of rebel provocation. It could have been an accident where chemical weapons had been moved into a certain place, but then they were released because of a conventional attack or because of an accident in handling them. So there are various possibilities. But the Obama administration jumped to this certainty about the Syrian government doing it. And that created a lot of, I think, reasonable doubts around the world. As a journalist, my view was, whenever I've seen these kinds of events going back really three decades now, going back to the Reagan administration when it made claims about chemical weapons, if you remember the Yellow Rain controversy,
mm-hmm.
in the 1980s, what we always try to do, what we're supposed to do as journalists, is say, okay, what's your evidence? And to the degree they present it, you then try to check it out and see if it checks out. And even in the case of President George W. Bush and the Iraq War in 2002-2003, when he was making the case that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was hiding them, he presented more evidence than the Obama administration was doing in this case. Now, granted, the evidence that Bush presented, a lot of it was false or turned out to be based on people lying, but there was at least something to work with. When we get to August 30th with this government assessment, the Obama administration basically said, "Trust us." And in the aftermath, a decade earlier of the Iraq War, it seemed rather presumptuous for the Obama administration to expect that the American people were simply going to trust us when it came to these kinds of questionable allegations. So that's where it stood, I think, at that point, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote these articles, pointing out the basic fact that there wasn't any evidence here. Mm-hmm. There was no evidence to check.
And Bob, you used the term dodgy dossier, and for me, that immediately links to the Downing Street memo when Sir David Manning, the U.S. ambassador from Britain to Washington, wrote to Blair that they were fixing the evidence around the policy. And this is a case where I have to really apply some of the same skepticism as you have suggested here, because Obama, you know, one of the few aspects of his foreign policy that I found praiseworthy was that he was resisting the repeated calls from Panetta, from Secretary of State Clinton, from the humanitarian hawks who have been promoted in his administration, Rice and Susan Power, Samantha Power, thank you. So the whiplash I have is that up until early August, the president was holding pretty firm that this was not in the U.S. interest, that while we deplore the violence and the death that are occurring in Syria, that there was no compelling reason for the United States to get directly involved. And then it appeared to be his own ego that he had tossed off this line about, you know, chemical weapons would cross a red line. And so he, you know, took us to the brink of war based on, you know, salvaging some sort of respect for an off-the-cuff, not a policy statement he had made, but just a response to a reporter. And so it really caused me to examine these issues very carefully. And I would say that to date, we still don't know precisely who was responsible for the release of what the UN says now was sarin gas in the Ghouta neighborhood. But, you know, the way all of this was managed was too reminiscent of the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Right. There's also now the question about the UN report. When the UN inspectors, despite initially the U.S. resistance to having the inspectors even bother to go into these neighborhoods to check them out, the UN insisted on doing it, and they did. They checked two areas. One was south of Damascus, and one was in the eastern, the Ghouta neighborhoods east of Damascus. And they produced a 38-page report, which had appendices. And that report did not draw any conclusions. They had gone in with the intention of not drawing any conclusions about who might have done it. And what they found, what they actually reported in the report, was much murkier than the way both the Obama administration and much of the mainstream press in the U.S. Have treated the findings. Basically, in the first site that the UN went to on August 26th, that was south of Damascus, they found no chemical warfare agents, no sarin or any other chemical warfare agents. They that was both in their field findings and when they sent it back to the two labs they were using. Now, the labs did find some trace amounts of industrial chemicals that can derive from sarin when it breaks down through thermal or other means. So they did sort of say, well, we think there might be sarin there, but there are also other explanations for that that would not involve a chemical attack on that area. Now, in the other neighborhood east of Damascus, which they went to 2 and 3 days later, they found plenty of sarin, both in their field accounts and in the labs. So clearly there was a release of sarin in that eastern neighborhood. It's more questionable about the southern neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they also said in the report, they included warnings saying it appears that these sites have been manipulated or may have been manipulated. That is, they were there, in their words, the custody of the rebels. And they were being led around, and they felt that things had been moved. They weren't sure what to make of stuff. They did do some rough calculations on where possibly these missiles might have come from the southern and the eastern neighborhood, even though the southern one, it's still questionable whether that was a chemical weapon attack.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they had very, very rough back-of-the-envelope kind of angles from these things, and that put the possible location, if you cross the two, into an area controlled by the Syrian government. And that sort of became the big story that the New York Times and Washington Post and others jumped on, saying, ha, this proves it. But again, one has to sit back and look and say, one has to be more skeptical, I think, when you're dealing with specific warnings from the UN inspectors that they are dubious about the conditions they're finding, whether they've been sort of staged in effect,
mm-hmm.
and whether they can be trusted. So this still brings to me the point that the United States and, frankly, the Russians, the Russians have a 100-page report which they say proves the rebels did it, but neither government has been willing to share that with the public. And this gets to a more troubling point, which is this addiction to secrecy
mm-hmm.
that we see on the part of many governments, where they don't want to share information with the public so things can be examined and independently inspected. They'd rather, they consider transparency, apparently, giving things to other insiders. President Obama, for instance, seems to think that transparency on these issues means sharing some stuff with Congress, and there are representatives, not making things public to the American people. And there's something very elitist and really anti-democratic about it. Plus, I think it's a way, when you don't have very strong evidence, you can count on most of the politicians either not to have the time to inspect things carefully or not to have the courage to. They have other agendas rather than the truth. So what you see here is this effort to sort of keep the American people out of any careful examination of the facts that could still lead us into a war. And what you saw when the president spoke before the UN, he said, essentially, no rational person can doubt this evidence, which to me is also concerning, because when you start saying something like that, we're not going to really show you our evidence, but anyone who doubts us is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way of sort of stampeding the process. And we've seen this again and again and again. We saw this with the Gulf of Tonkin back in 1964, when doubts about that were sort of overridden. Oh, anyone who has doubts must be a communist sympathizer. Or we saw it in the 80s when President Reagan would sell us on a whole variety of crazy allegations, like the Yellow Rain incident, which turned out to be something totally different, not chemical weapons at all. And you saw it in 2002 and 2003, and you're seeing it again. And so there's something anti-empirical when, instead of presenting your evidence in a coherent way, you simply say, oh, anybody who doubts us is a nut. And that's pretty much what President Obama said, and it's kind of what the American mainstream press is going with right now, not having apparently learned anything from 10 years ago. And I think that's where the American people really need to put their foot down.
And Bob, when we zoom out and look at the similarities, the rebel forces in Syria, and we'll get to the breakdown of who they actually are a little bit later here, but you know, they are looking for outside intervention in the same way that Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress were desperate to find some way to get the U.S. to enter Iraq and take out Saddam Hussein. And so we end up in this kind of leveraged rhetorical zone where, because Assad is a brutal dictator and because he has presided over this lengthy civil war, there is a presumption that he is all evil and that we can never believe anything that he says. And so it makes him an easy target for a setup. And again, I don't have proof yet that this was a setup, but I am deeply suspicious. And at this point, I want to go to the role of Prince Bandar and Saudi Arabia, because you're not the first to draw inferences about his linkage to the Chechen fighters who have been inserted into Syria. His very frank and blunt conversation, including veiled threats to Putin, don't seem very smart. And while the Mint Press story has been discredited, the elements in there were reporting that it was Saudi Arabia who had supplied some sort of a chemical weapon to one of the rebel groups in Syria. And so with that basic information and knowing the very strong propaganda operations that are underway, the Syrian Observatory, this guy Danny, who pops up on CNN occasionally and has been outed as he was getting ready to do a live shot with Anderson Cooper, telling a buddy off camera to be ready to roll the sound effects of gunfire. And so I think we have to be extremely skeptical. I think the president was, until his mythical red line was crossed, and all of a sudden he is taking us to the brink of war and really defying most American public opinion, most members of his own party, and large portions of the world community.
Well, I think that's true. I think President Obama, I think personally, did not want to get into a war, and that's not an insignificant distinction between what's happening now and what happened 10 years ago. President Bush wanted to get into a war. There was just no question about it. He really didn't care particularly what the reasons were.
Mm-hmm.
He was just going to do it. Whatever his ultimate motives are, there remains somewhat still a mystery to many of us. But he was certainly just manipulating the facts and going with whatever sketchy evidence that might exist that he could use and pushing us in that direction. I think President Obama doesn't want to go to war, but he has continually, and I think rather foolishly, surrounded himself with war hawks or people that are much more inclined to go to war than he is. And we saw that when he first came in with his so-called team of rivals, where he kept on Robert Gates, who had been a longtime CIA hawk, going back to the Cold War, who had been Bush's defense secretary, pushing the surge in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kept on because it was considered kind of a smart political play to have a Republican. He brought in Hillary Clinton, who was sort of a neocon light, sort of a Democratic hawk in many of these areas as Secretary of State. He kept on people like David Petraeus, the general who had been one of the masterminds of both Iraq and then later Afghanistan, the policies there, who then moved on to be CIA director before he flamed out over a sex scandal. But so essentially Obama thought it might was sort of, I guess, politically providing some protection to have all these hawks around him. But then he got through his first term. It seemed in his second term maybe he was going to move in a different direction. But he seems to have, again, surrounded himself with fairly hawkish people. Senator Kerry, now Secretary of State Kerry, has seemed to be in a very aggressive way, carried this ball on Syria. Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, Samantha Power, the UN ambassador, are also big advocates for pushing for some kind of greater military intervention in Syria. So he seems to have placed himself in the midst of these more hawkish advisors and then tries to figure a way out of it. And I think he sort of did, with the help of President Putin of Russia in this case and the willingness of Assad to make concessions on his chemical weapon arsenal, But I think it's still very dangerous, and it also suggests that, as you pointed out earlier, we should be very suspicious, because you do have very powerful forces, very sophisticated forces, both in the United States and in the Middle East, trying to get the United States to intervene militarily to essentially hand the rebels in Syria a victory, to do regime change. And that's very similar to what we saw on Iraq, where you had, in that case, the Iraqi National Congress was bringing in walk-ins to the CIA, who would testify falsely, it turned out, that they were part of various WMD programs in Iraq. So you had roughly 18 of these walk-ins, some of whom were debunked by the CIA, but others, it was hard to debunk everybody when they're coming in and making claims. Plus, there was the pressure from the Bush administration not to debunk them.
Right.
And you have a similar pattern here, where you have a number of people trying to push various arguments to get the United States involved militarily. You don't have any much of an institutional counterforce for this, trying to demand a more skepticism. And so you could very easily find yourself, the president could find himself put back in a corner, partly of his own making, because he's surrounded himself with advisors who want him to be in that corner. But I do think he did show some flexibility when he was faced with this prospect of launching these strikes. And another interesting secret, because everything was being kept secret from the American people at that time. If you remember when Secretary Kerry, Secretary Hagel, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were testifying before the Senate, they were asked about what are the estimates of civilian deaths that would result from a cruise missile strike carried out by the United States. And the answer was, we'll get into that in classified session. So even something like how many civilians are we going to kill was something they wanted to keep away from the American people. And it seems to me that if you want to get the American people back into another war, those sorts of details should not be kept in classified session. They should be presented publicly. We think we'll kill 500 children or whatever the number is if we do this. And then we can decide more as adults whether we think it's worth killing those children or not. But that's all kept from us, so it can be sort of kept more. So the idea of opposing this will be harder to develop, and it just goes to this real addiction to secrecy that we've seen continue through the Obama administration, despite all its protestation about its desire for transparency. And we see it with other countries too. We see it certainly with the Russians. They've been if they have a 100-page report saying the rebels did it, let's see their evidence.
Mm-hmm. Bob Perry, I'm going to link to two of your recent articles at consortiumnews.com in the show file for this podcast. But take a moment here to summarize for our listeners the discussion between Prince Bandar and Vladimir Putin at a meeting in Moscow on July 31st.
Well, it appears that the Saudis, who've taken a very profound role in the Syrian operation, they've been crucial in terms of pulling together the support for the rebels, and particularly the most radical Islamists among the radicals. There's been a surge of Arab of cross national Arab jihadists coming into Syria to carry on this war. And they've been the most effective fighters in many ways, and clearly the most ruthless and brutal. So the Saudis have been helping to pull that together, as they have in the past. The Saudis also played a key role, as we remember, going back to the 80s, in helping to create Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden was, after all, a Saudi, and did get funding and support from Prince Bandar, who then was the U.S. ambassador, or the ambassador of the United States, and now is head of their intelligence service. In fact, Bandar once said he met bin Laden in the context of bin Laden thanking him for the help that he had been able to provide to bin Laden's forces.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have Bandar acting as the head of Saudi intelligence, And he went to Moscow apparently with the idea that he could use inducements of bribery and veiled threats to get the Russians to agree to back off their support for the Syrian government, to further enable the Saudi-backed rebels to win this conflict. And there were offers of deals for oil and different ways that Saudis could be helpful to the Russians financially. And in the context, according to a diplomatic account of this that came out weeks later, Bandar also made a point that the Saudis had been supporting the Chechen rebels, who are considered by the Russians to be terrorists, and that the Saudis could keep them, the Chechens, from attacking the Winter Olympics in Sochi, which would be happening next year. And at this point, Putin, who was apparently trying to be fairly polite in this context, became somewhat outraged that Bandar would be so blunt about his support for the Chechens, who, despite having some legitimate grievances with the Russians, surely, mm-hmm. also some elements of them have engaged in acts of massive terrorism, bombing apartment buildings in Russia, killing children.
Schools, yeah.
Right. And this idea of this implicit threat against the Olympics, it's a bit like a mafia don saying, you know, telling a shopkeeper he should pay some protection money because, you know, it's a nice business you got going here. It'd be awful if something happened to it.
I think shakedowns with Putin are a one-way street. He does the shakedown, but he doesn't like to be shook.
well, right. He's not one to really mess with in this regard. But it's certainly an interesting point that the Saudis now see themselves, and they've developed a sort of, I'm told, a working relationship at an intelligence level, at least with the Israelis. They both share a lot of common interests now. They are on the same side of the Egyptian conflict. They both supported the ouster of the Muslim Brotherhood and the imposition of the military coup. The Israelis defended that diplomatically and politically in the United States. The Saudis provided the money. We've seen something similar going on with both sides see Iran as their principal enemy. Both see the Shiite crescent of Iranian influence reaching from Iraq through Syria to Lebanon as being their geopolitical concern. Both are on the side of the rebels fighting in Syria. And in fact, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Oren, said that Israel would prefer the most hardline al-Qaeda-connected rebels winning if that was the only way to get rid of Assad. They see Assad as a bigger threat and problem than an al-Qaeda-related government in Syria, which is also the Saudi position. So you have this joint now working relationship that has evolved, which has tremendous power. Saudis with their money, oil, finance, the Israelis obviously with their political influence around the world, and so I guess it makes sense for Bandar, who is a very smart man, who has obviously manipulated the United States quite effectively when he was the ambassador here, for him to think, well, I guess we can probably do the same with the Russians. We can go up there and throw around some money or promises of financial help, oil deals, and arranging to keep energy prices high, things the Russians might like, and with these sort of implicit threats that if they step out of line, we can unleash some terrorist attacks on them, that would work. But instead, it tended to backfire. And I'm even told that the Russians are, of course, weaker on the sort of soft power side of things, but they have plenty of hard power, that they've even talked about possible military retaliation, although that is not something they want to do or that is, I think, at all likely. But it is where the Russians now see this. They've dug in much harder in relation to Syria than they might have if Bandar had not made this this presentation.
Mm-hmm. And you quote this diplomatic report, quoting Bandar thusly, "The Chechen groups that threaten the security of the Winter Olympics are controlled by us, and they will not move in the Syrian territories direction without coordinating with us. These groups do not scare us. We use them in the face of the Syrian regime, but they will have no role or influence in Syria's political future. Now, likewise, the al-Nusra Front, which is described in the American media as the one aligned with al-Qaeda, and I'm always dubious about these alleged alignments. There's no franchise license that I know of that comes from al-Qaeda HQ to these various splinter groups. But certainly they have a philosophical alliance at minimum. And that's just two of the group, what I call the mercenary melting pot in Syria. And this points up a larger fallacy in American policy that has been articulated by Senator Carl Levin and others, and that is that there are vetted moderate groups, the Free Syrian Army and some others aligned with it, that we can supply arms to without fear that they're going to fall into the hands of these other outside finance mercenary groups, we can actually try to tip the scales in favor of pro-Western groups who might survive and end up running Syria a year or two from now. But all of this is so dicey because I don't really believe this idea that there are vetted moderates and that somehow we can keep the serial numbers of the weapons we give them and be able to make sure that they're never pointed against us.
Well, I think that's a very good point. It's also true now that the real obstacle to a political settlement in Syria, which is the only way this awful killing is going to be brought to some kind of a conclusion, at least limited conclusion, is to have these meetings in Geneva, and to have some kind of power sharing relationship developed where the Sunnis get more of a say, where the Alawites are protected still, the Alawites being essentially the Assad side of this equation. And whether what happens to Assad is, I think there's general agreement he has to go, even from the point of view of the Russians. But maybe there'll be someone from his circle who might be able to be part of this power-sharing relationship. Now, so that's probably the only way to end this at this stage, to stop this awful killing, which is done primarily with conventional weapons, not chemical, but there needs to be some kind of political settlement. Everyone sort of agrees to that idea. The Russians and the Americans have called for these meetings in Geneva. The Assad regime has agreed to send representatives to negotiate. The side that won't negotiate is the rebel side. And the U.S. has not been able to bring those folks to the bargaining table. They instead, both the so-called moderates and the more radical elements, keep saying before they'll negotiate, they're demanding more sophisticated American weapons. They're demanding that they be in a position of victory before they'll talk about anything. Now, they demand that Assad resign as a precondition rather than as a result. So they've been putting all these obstacles in the way of a peace process. And what we've seen in the U.S. press corps is sort of curious. And this is people like Nick Kristof of the New York Times.
Yeah.
Since the idea of the United States supporting the side that won't do peace talks somehow seems counterintuitive to many, they've just changed the narrative. They've essentially, people like Kristof have falsified the narrative, and they've said we have to put on more pressure to get Assad to agree to go to the bargaining table. But Assad's already agreed to go to the bargaining table. The point is that it's the rebels, and to some degree it's because these so-called moderates really are not in control anymore. The people that the U.S. perhaps could pressure to get them to go to Geneva, they're not really the people calling the shots as much as these more radical jihadists who have the strong backing of Saudi Arabia and some of the Persian Gulf states. So they've got a lot of money, and they've got a lot of weaponry of their own, and they're not interested in some kind of peace deal. They're much too radical for that.
And I was struck, like you, by Kristof's recent column because, you know, he has a track record as a compassionate journalist who has written bleeding heart stories about victims of human trafficking, sex trafficking, you know, many, many other issues like that. And so he wrote this column, which depicts a seventh grader who has protested the regime, and his teacher was killed. All kinds of bad things have happened. And it really does depict the brutality of the Assad government. And then in his close, his summation, he went into a zone that I found hard to accept, where he's just saying we should be arming the rebels, and he supports strikes on the Syrian military. Well, I really don't understand how injecting more arms into a tinderbox, when we can't even define, you know, who the opposition members are, and to assume that that is somehow going to produce a result of less killing, either in the short term or the long term, just it doesn't pass a basic rational test, Bob.
Well, and also some of the more extreme rebels have shown themselves to be utter barbarians,
yeah,
too. And this is not to be any kind of excuse for the Assad regime, which has been brutal toward what was first a fairly peaceful opposition. But you have these rebels, some of them filming themselves executing unarmed captured soldiers. You have there's one rather grotesque scene of them chopping out the internal organs of a rebel of a government soldier who'd been killed, mm-hmm, and eating it. So I mean, you're not dealing here with some people who on the rebel side are entirely white hats. If you listen to even what Ambassador Oren says, the Israeli government would prefer to have those folks in charge of Damascus than Assad, which strikes me as a rather extreme position, and perhaps one that maybe the Israelis feel they can live with, although I think they're perhaps underestimating some of the danger there. But it's something that the United States may feel differently about. But the key point is, the only way this killing stops, really, is for the various sides to be brought together at a peace conference to get a ceasefire and then a new political arrangement for Syria.
And here's
the
my...
The folks who aren't doing it are the rebels. The people who won't go are the rebels, not the Assad government. The Assad government has agreed to send representatives.
And Bob, here's my fundamental beef, that Obama took the emotional charge that was available following the events of August 21st, irrespective of who may have caused it, and squandered it by threatening an attack on the Assad government, instead of using it to build some sort of consensus that all kinds of violence, including the use or possible use of chemical weapons, must stop immediately. And that's what I find so confounding, is instead of trying to, you know, stop this civil war completely, it was just, well, you know, we want to spank Assad because we believe he used chemical weapons, and this violated a promise made by the president.
Right, and I think as people have noted, many, many more people have died in Syria from conventional weapons. As awful as chemical weapons are, and as indiscriminate as they are, conventional weapons can be very indiscriminate too. If you go back to 2004, when George W. Bush got angry at the city of Fallujah for some brutal events that occurred there, city was basically leveled by the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and there were allegations of the United States using things like phosphorus and other
shake and bake
chemical type weapons and mm-hmm. so forth. But the point was that the United States has responded in this kind of brutal way fairly recently. But the bigger point is that if you want to end that kind of killing, whether by conventional weapons or chemical weapons or any other kind of weapons, you need to have some kind of peace agreement. You need to have some kind of political arrangement that is struck, and that's been a problem where people like Christoph can't face up to that basic fact that it is the side he's supporting, the rebels, who won't agree to a peace deal. So he just changes the storyline, which is not appropriate for a journalist to do.
Mm-hmm.
You may not like, you may favor, in his case, he's a columnist, if he wants to favor one side over another, I guess he has that right, but you shouldn't change the facts. And the New York Times itself, to its credit, over the past several months, going from May through July mostly, the Times has reported the facts that the Syrian government has agreed to go to the peace talks, and the rebels have found reason after reason after reason not to. And that's the key point, it seems to me, that the U.S. press doesn't want to deal with. And frankly, the Obama administration has tried to sort of downplay, because that just raises more doubts as to what the United States is up to. If it can't pressure the rebels who are dependent on outside help to a great extent, if the U.S. and its allies can't pressure the rebels to go to Geneva to at least talk, one has to wonder who's running this show.
Another element of hypocrisy, or at least a lack of credibility on the part of the United States, Bob, has been pointed out in a report by Dave Lindorf, published over at whowhatwhy.com. And that is that while the U.S. signed the Chemical Weapons Convention in 1997, we ratified it at that point, we still have three times as many chemical weapons as Syria does. We have 3,100 tons that are stored in Pueblo, Colorado, and Bluegrass, Kentucky. And we have actually asked for an extension on destroying these chemical weapons because, I don't know, we've apparently encountered some difficulties in disposing of them. And the idea that international forces, with or without powder blue helmets, can march into Syria in the middle of a civil war, locate, secure, and remove chemical weapons without them either, you know, falling into the wrong hands or, you know, being used as a hostage type device or blackmail device. This is all fairly far-fetched, and I certainly support this diplomatic approach far more than any kind of a military approach, but it's not easy to simply secure and remove these chemical weapons.
Right. It would, in a way, it gives some of the rebel groups veto power over what happens, because assuming there's no ceasefire, assuming there are no peace talks, which I guess the rebels don't want to see happen, then you have UN inspectors, people either unarmed or very lightly armed, going in with trucks, I presume, into these into various sections of virtual battle zones in Syria to locate these sites for these chemical weapons, and then either try to destroy them on site or take them out, I guess, by truck through other areas that might be under some kind of military challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's fraught with danger, and even identifying all where they are could invite some of these extreme rebel groups to try to take them.
Yeah,
and so to enhance their arsenal, and apparently they do have the rebels do have some level of chemical weaponry themselves, which is one of the interesting points about that U.S. government assessment from August 30th. You almost have to read between the lines on some of these kinds of documents. The U.S., you would expect the U.S. government to have simply said, the rebels have no chemical weapons, period. That's why we're sure that the Assad regime did this. That's not what the white paper says. The white paper says, we assess, based on our sources, that the rebels were not preparing for a chemical attack on August 21st. What that's not saying is, the dog not barking, is that the rebels, it suggests, if you read it indirectly, that the rebels have chemical weapons, at least that's the view of U.S. intelligence, but they just didn't use them on this occasion. And that's an important point, because if you accept that, or if at least some parts of U.S. intelligence, and that seems to be the message we're getting here, believe that the rebels have chemical weapons, then how this release happened in Ghouta, the eastern suburb of Damascus, is more problematic and more questionable and requires more serious assessment than it's gotten.
There's another element of contradiction in that it was officially leaked that there was an intercept of communications between apparently high-ranking members of the Syrian military. The problem is that this intercept was attributed to a joint U.S.-British listening post on a mountaintop in Cyprus, and the British claim that they had no record of that, and this gets even more hard to explain when we're told that the U.S. had some inkling 3 days before, apparently through these intercepted communications, that there was about to be a use of chemical weapons. In this case, I presume they thought it was the Syrian military who was going to use them. And yet there was no effort to warn people. And one of the crazy ideas I've thrown out, Bob, is that if Obama wanted to make a real point about protecting innocent people, including children, from chemical weapons, we should drop a million gas masks and biological protective suits from the skies into Syria. And that would certainly make a very powerful point that we oppose this kind of warfare and that we want the violence to stop. And yet, you know, we were going to use cruise missiles, and we continue to talk about arming some of the rebels. And these, of course, would just cause more suffering and death.
Well, but getting back to your point about the intercept, that was considered the prime evidence presented by Secretary Kerry, and in that August 30th report. It's described as a senior official of the Syrian government essentially admitting, conceding that the government had carried it out. Now, that's never been produced. And one would think that if the United States had an intercept like that, the fact the U.S. can intercept phone calls is not exactly a top-secret thing anymore. and in fact, when Colin Powell, when Secretary of State Colin Powell gave his famous presentation at the UN in 2003, he included intercepts of Iraqi officials talking about possible WMD. It turned out that he had doctored some of that, but at least they presented the transcript, a supposed transcript, of conversations they'd intercepted. The Obama administration wouldn't even do that. It did not release this transcript. It simply made this assertion. And interestingly, when President Obama gave his speech on Syria a couple weeks later, he didn't include this. He made reference to the Syrian officials doing a review after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and I think one thing we've learned in when we've watched these various, the way this propaganda plays out, is that sometimes there'll be a claim made, the intelligence community will say, hey, that really isn't true, and then it quietly is dropped. We saw this, for instance, when President Bush, in his State of the Union in 2003, makes reference to the Niger uranium mm-hmm. that Iraqis were supposedly trying to get. And then when Colin Powell talks about it a week or so later in the UN, that is dropped.
Right.
And it was dropped because the U.S. intelligence came in and said, listen, that's wrong. We know it's wrong. So what does it mean when President Obama drops a key part of the case when he makes his speech on this? Now, we don't want to overstate something, but there's been a complete failure of the U.S. government to provide those transcripts, which the U.S. government claims to possess. Now, why? It can't be that, oh, my goodness, the United States can intercept phone calls. That's been known for decades. So one has to assume that the context of that phone call is not as clear-cut as Secretary Kerry was trying to present, in which case that is, in a sense, prima facie the evidence that we're being misled. And so you have those kinds of issues that I think that still need to be dealt with. And when President Obama, as he did in his speech to the UN on Tuesday, when he said that no rational person could still have doubts about this, about the Syrian government being responsible, I think he's an essentially trying to stampede the process to prevent anyone from saying, hold it, why can't you people present some real evidence?
And here's a quote from the president's speech, according to the Associated Press. It's an insult to human reason and to the legitimacy of this institution, the UN, to suggest that anyone other than the regime carried out this attack.
Right.
And, you know, that really is a trust me kind of statement. And Obama needs to understand that we don't trust him, that we can't trust him, that he has proven to be a dissembler, to try to represent that people weren't being targeted for surveillance when it's now very clear that they were. And he really has shattered his credibility. And when he tries to double down with a statement like this, it really compounds the problem.
Right. And it's not just that we don't trust Obama. It's that as journalists, we shouldn't trust anybody. And certainly with something as serious as war or peace, it's to basically insult anybody, which is what he's doing there, insulting anyone who says, hey, listen, we need to see some serious evidence here. Let's lay the evidence out. Let's have the Russians lay their evidence out. You lay your evidence out. We'll work through it. You know, as a world community, we'll work through it. Instead, he says, no, we're not going to do that. You have to be crazy. That's what he's basically saying there, isn't he? Mm-hmm. You have to be kind of crazy to think that it's not as we say it is. So we're not going to bother to lay our evidence out. Secretary Kerry had also said previous to that speech that the United States would not engage in this kind of comparing evidence with the Russians. He said it's a waste of time. So, but is it really a waste of time to go through? If you think your case is a slam dunk, mm-hmm. to use a phrase, why not invite that? And we've seen in the past the United States has invited that, sometimes falsely, by the way, but and sometimes honestly. The famous case of the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962, when Ambassador Stevenson presented then very sensitive information from high-level photography of Cuba showing mm-hmm. where the missile sites were that had been placed there. We saw it done in a dishonest way in the case of when the Reagan people presented their evidence regarding when the Soviets shot down the KL Flight 007 mm-hmm. In the 1980s. And basically, we now know that the Reagan administration doctored the tapes. They cut it and sliced it and made it appear something that it wasn't. It was an accident. They try to make it presented as a willful act of murder. So you have cases where the U.S. government has presented very sensitive material before the UN, the same place we're talking about. But here, the Obama administration, even in the wake of Iraq, says no, we're not going to do it. You have to be crazy to ask us. That strikes me as not a very persuasive way of doing things. It's a bullying way.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of asking everybody to pound on anyone who's still a skeptic and call them names. But that's not an act of reason. That's an act of propaganda and political pressure.
Yeah, and you know, I would be very pleased, not happy, but pleased to concede the point to the president and the administration when they provide the proof. It's not as if I'm invested in believing one way or the other, but I smell a rat, and I don't know if I've ever told you this before, but I was one of the people who was snookered by the Hill and Knowlton pro-Kuwaiti propaganda during Operation Desert Storm. And they brought the daughter of the Saudi ambassador to my radio studio in San Francisco and fed me the line that she had witnessed Iraqi soldiers dumping Kuwaiti babies out of incubators at the hospital in Kuwait City. And I was skeptical, but I had no proof at that point that this wasn't true. And so having been burned by that, it really sets my bullshit detector at a very sensitive level, Bob. And this sequence of events had the detector working overtime.
Well, I agree with you. If they have the evidence, let's present it. And if indeed Assad is guilty, there's still always this question, why would he have done this attack at that time in that place when the UN had just shown up to do some other inspections? But maybe people do crazy things in war. I've written that. You know, sometimes people, whether a military unit that's out of control or whether a leader has sort of lost his mind, people do things that don't quite make sense in war, especially when things are getting pretty nasty. But that is something that is a question that the evidence should respond to, that the evidence should be so clear-cut that we can say, yes, Assad did it. And we know why he did it and how he did it. But to go with this idea that we're just going to throw out some half-baked evidence just because the New York Times and some other folks are persuaded by it and then say that's the end of the story is dangerous and insulting. especially when you consider that the New York Times was the same newspaper that went out and decided that since Saddam Hussein was getting some aluminum tubes, they just had to be for nuclear weapons centrifuges, which of course turned out to be one of the biggest lies of the pre-Iraq war period. So when you have that history, it seems that, and President Obama has acknowledged that as the backdrop for the skepticism about Syria, but instead of responding to that skepticism by saying, so we're going to do more evidence than you might ever expect, we're going to prove very strongly that Assad did this, he's gone in the opposite direction. He has said, we're just not going to give you any evidence, and you're crazy if you ask.
Yeah.
And you should have your detector working overtime when a politician says those kinds of things.
Bob Perry, I always appreciate your commentary and analysis. Thank you for joining us today. And I note that I have been remiss because I have not seen a copy of America's Stolen Narrative, your most recent book. Tell us a little bit about that and how people can get a copy.
Well, it's a book about how America's, in a way, lost its direction because it doesn't really know where it came from anymore. And that is not just a case of people forgetting or just by accident getting lost. This is an effort that's part of especially from the American right to essentially create a false narrative that goes back from to the beginning to the founding and efforts to change what the framers of the Constitution were trying to do, trying to create a narrative that they were against a strong federal government. They were big for states' rights when, in fact, the people that wrote the Constitution had the absolute opposite point of view of that. They were very much for a strong central government, and they were highly suspicious and opposed to states' rights. So it looks back at some of that history, but then it takes you into more current time frame where our understanding of key events has been falsified. Because either we've been denied key facts, or because government has lied. And one of the points I go to is 1968, with the issue of the what happened to the Vietnam peace talks then. And I was able to discover some new documentary evidence at the Johnson Library in Austin, Texas, which now shows quite strongly that then Republican candidate Richard Nixon sabotaged the Vietnam peace talks because he felt that would help him win the election, and that interestingly Johnson knew all about it. He'd ordered buggings of some of the phones and had ascertained what had happened, and there were even some possible press accounts that could have come out at the time, but that the secrets were kept, that in part because the Johnson administration feared what would happen if they came out with this story about Nixon sabotaging the peace talks and he still won the election. Would that basically destroy the U.S. government's credibility on a number of issues? So for various reasons, this was kept secret. And so it's a remarkable story of how we ended up with the destructive last 4 years of the Vietnam War and all that meant to the United States, tearing apart our political fabric, tearing families apart, really, and of course, leading to massive deaths in Indochina and another 20,000 additional American deaths in the war. And then I look at how, what happened after that, and it's an interesting tie-in between what we now know about 68 and Nixon then learned, after he became president, he learned that Johnson had known about what he was doing.
Yeah.
But there was a missing file that Johnson had removed from the White House, the one that I discovered at the library, and that was and Nixon began a frantic search for that file, which ultimately leads him to organize the plumbers, so you can see the connections between these kinds of events going into Watergate and the destruction of Nixon's presidency, and then I also go through some very fascinating new material about how there was a sort of a reprise of the same sort of dirty trick in 1980 when the Republicans again wanted to win the White House.
The October surprise.
And they undercut President Carter in a similar way that they had undercut President Johnson. So it's an interesting story that brings much of this new evidence to the fore, things that people haven't seen before, and it changes how we understand some of the key chapters of the American narrative.
Mm-hmm. The new book is called America's Stolen Narrative, and if you go to consortiumnews.com, are there links to purchase the book?
Sure, you can get it through Amazon, or you can go to the consortiumnews.com website and buy it directly that way.
Great. Well, Bob, thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Robert Perry from consortiumnews.com. I appreciate your comments. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.